story. Anyway, were they nice, the Nielsens? Did you end up with them for good? They didn't sound all that nice, Molly says. They didn't? Well, actually, they were. Quiet people, yes. Never very demonstrative, do you know what that means? They didn't show much of what they felt, but they were decent and kind in their own way. We got used to each other, slowly, and eventually I believe we even came to love each other. After all I'd been through, it was enough. Molly can understand that. Sometimes you don't look for perfect. Sometimes enough is the most you can hope for. Maybe that's what she'll get at Ralph and Dina's. She's not sure. A week has passed since the big argument over the book and Dina's apology. Things are better between them, for sure. Dina has been friendlier and Ralph seems relieved. A few days ago, they came to Molly together to tell her she was welcome to stay. The question is, does she want to? Maybe Dina will never be Molly's favorite person. Maybe Molly will never be Dina's either. But if she stays at their house, she'll still be in Spruce Harbor, where she might be able to make a new friend or two, like Megan, where she can patch things up with Jack, the friend she already has, and where she can still come and see Vivian. After all Molly's been through, maybe it's enough. Several years after the Nielsens took me in, they adopted me, Vivian goes on. They had already asked if I'd change my name to the name of their daughter, who'd died. Vivian, Molly says. That's right, Vivian. And didn't you mind? Molly can't imagine Ralph or Dina asking if she'd change the name she's had all her life, the name her father gave her. No more Molly Molasses? Well, I didn't have much reason to be attached to the name Dorothy, Vivian says. And I knew they wouldn't go for Neve. I think it gave Mrs. Nielsen some comfort to give me that name. And you worked in the store for them? Molly asks. Vivian nods. I was quite good at it, as a matter of fact. Doing the accounts, the ordering. I became an expert at watching people, at guessing what they might want. Mr. Nielsen came to rely on me very much. Once I graduated from high school, I managed the store, and when they died, they left everything to me. My husband and I ran it together until we decided to retire. Molly's head is spinning a little. She's been so deep into Vivian's story, imagining the life of that girl traveling on a train, going from one family to the next, carrying her few possessions with her like a Wabanaki used to, that she'd almost forgotten that a lot has happened to Vivian since then. Did you ever hear anything about any of the other children on the train? She asks, like Carmine or Dutchie.
Carmine? No, I never heard anything about him. But Dutchie?
She lets out a big sigh. What?
Goodness, yes, child, I thought I told you.
Molly shakes her head. Well, it will be one last thing to add to your report. When I was 19, I went into Minneapolis with two of my friends to see The Wizard of Oz. I'd never seen a motion picture in color before. Never? Molly asks. Don't look so surprised. Color movies were very rare back then. Vivian looks away, into the distance, at something Molly can't see.
You've seen movies in color since before you could talk. But it was magical to me.
It doesn't seem foolish to Molly at all. She can imagine how it must have felt, walking out of that theater, as if Oz could be right around the corner, as if the gray, ordinary world might vanish any second, and a world of color open up. After the movie, I was sitting in the lobby of a hotel, waiting for my friends, Vivian goes on, and a man walked by. He stopped and looked at me. I noticed his eyes. They were very blue. Startling. He asked if he knew me from somewhere.
So, did you know him? Molly asks.
I didn't think so, not at first. It wasn't normal, you know, for a man to just stop and talk to a woman like that. I was annoyed. I thought he was going to be a bother, and that I'd have to go to the hotel desk and ask someone to escort him out. But then he asked if I had traveled from New York to Minnesota on a train when I was young. And he called me Neve. It had been so long since anyone used that name, I almost couldn't answer.
Molly sits up straight. Was it Dutchie?
She gives Molly a broad smile.
Yes, it was Dutchie.
What had happened to him? Molly asks. Did he get adopted? Were those people who took him off the train as awful as they seemed?
Quite as awful, I'm sorry to say, Vivian answers.
He ran away. He was taken in by another farmer, a much kinder man. By the time I met Dutchie in the hotel lobby that night, he'd become a musician. He played the piano in bars or nightclubs, mostly.
And you got to be friends with him, Molly asks. You stayed in touch and everything?
A little more than that, Vivian answers. We were married 10 months later. Mrs. Murphy gave me a tea set, just like hers, for a wedding present.
Molly stares in astonishment.
You married him?
I married him. He was the only one who understood. You see, just what my life had been like, that is, until you came to clean out my attic.
Vivian smiles, running a finger around the rim of her teacup with its blooming red roses.
Molly smiles back.
I've never told anyone else about my early life, Vivian continues. I didn't even tell the Nielsens. We didn't discuss things much in those days. Nowadays, people talk about everything. There are therapists and counselors and all that.
Vivian shakes her head as if it's too much to understand.
But when I was young, we just got on with things. The Nielsens didn't ask me much, and I didn't tell them. And then, 8 decades later, you come along with your blue hair and your black fingernails and that little recorder of yours. I never could have imagined that you'd be the one I'd tell.
Molly feels a glow of happiness, but it quickly fades. Something feels wrong, and after a moment, she realizes what it is.
Vivian's story will never be complete until she knows about Maisie. Molly is going to have to figure out a way to tell her. But before that, there's something else she needs to get off her chest.
Chapter 21. Molly, Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day. Molly hopes the bear charm on her necklace will give her courage. She needs it now, even more than she needed it when she walked into the library and saw Mrs. LeBlanc at the desk.
There's something I should have told you when I met you, she says to Vivian. The community service thing wasn't for school, not really.
Oh?
Vivian lifts her eyebrows.
I stole something.
The words are stiff and heavy as Molly forces them out of her mouth.
A book from the library.
I see.
It was a stupid thing to do, Molly admits.
What book was it?
She looks at Vivian in surprise. This is not what she expected her to ask.
The Secret Garden.
Did Terry know?
Molly hesitates. She doesn't want to get Terry into trouble. If she does, there's no way Jack will ever forgive her.
I think Terry asked you because Jack asked her, she says, slowly, feeling her way.
To help me out, you know how she feels about Jack.
That I do.
I'm not a thief, Molly says suddenly, urgently. She can't read the expression on Vivian's face. Is she angry? Disgusted? Does she think Molly is a terrible person?
I mean, I guess I am, but I gave the book back.
No, she needs to be absolutely truthful here.
They took it back. Really? But I've never stolen anything else, not even a bar of candy.
Maybe her dad's charms saved her from that sort of thing.
But I'm sorry I didn't tell you before.
Well, perhaps it was for the best, Vivian says thoughtfully. I probably wouldn't have agreed to let you help me.
had I known. And then look at all I would have missed.
She studies Molly, the old sharp interest back in her eyes.
The Secret Garden? I know that book, yes. A girl and a boy, dreadful little children, both practically orphans, like you and me.
Don't you mind? Molly asks nervously. Vivian lifts her shoulders.
You've certainly paid your dues, all those hours in the attic, and before you even got here, I expect.
She smiles.
I think we should forget all about it.
Molly smiles back, feeling a wave of relief wash over her. But she knows the time has come to tell Vivian the rest of the story. She takes a deep breath. There's something else I need to say.
Oh, Lord.
Vivian takes a sip of cold tea and sets her cup down.
What have you done now?
It's not about me, Molly says. It's about Maisie. Vivian's hand freezes on her flowery teacup.
Maisie?
Molly's heart is beating quickly and shallowly like a rabbit's. Will this news upset Vivian? Make her angry? Will she think Molly was poking her nose into something that was none of her business? Well, it's too late to stop now. I went online, Molly says, the words coming out in a rush. I just wanted to see if I could find something, pictures, really, for my project. I found stuff from Ellis Island, the ship you were on from Ireland.
The Agnes Pauline, uh-huh.
Molly looks at her own fingers on the arm of her chair, keeping her eyes away from Vivian. And I saw a newspaper article about the fire, about your mom and dad and brothers dying, but it didn't say anything about Maisie, so I kept looking, and then I...
What, child? For goodness sake, just tell me.
The Schatzmans, Molly says. There was a family reunion site and a picture. The Schatzmans adopted a baby in 1930. Her name was Margaret.
Margaret.
Molly nods.
Maisie?
Vivian breathes.
She didn't die in the fire?
Molly nods again. Now that she's started, she has to tell the rest of it quickly. She can't let Vivian begin to hope. But she... I'm really sorry, Vivian. She died 6 months ago. She was 83. Vivian is very still. It said... That family reunion website said that everybody was surprised she lived after the fire. When she was a baby, the doctors and all. But she got better, and then... There was no one, I guess, no family, and they adopted her. The Schatzmans. Molly nods.
Yes, I'm sorry.
But she lived a long time. She had children and grandchildren and all that.
All these years,
Vivian says, very softly.
All these years she was alive, and I didn't know it.
She looked happy, Molly says, tentatively. She reaches down into her backpack, lying at her feet, and pulls out the pages she printed at the library. She unfolds them gently and holds them out to Vivian. See? She really does. I think she had a happy life. Vivian drops her eyes to the pages. She's silent for a moment, then she murmurs,
Yes, I see. Yes. You're right. She does look happy.
Slowly, she puts out a finger to touch the face of her sister.
Lost and found and lost again.
Molly stacks the pages of her report in the middle of her desk, making sure all the edges are perfectly aligned. She puts a staple neatly through the upper left-hand corner. Her portaging project is finished. She typed up all of Vivian's memories, the ones on the recorder, the ones she wrote down in her notebook, Elizabeth Street, the fire, the train, the Burns and the Groats, Miss Larson and Mrs. Murphy, the Nielsens, Duchy. She went back to the library once more, and Mrs. LeBlanc helped her find pictures to add. The Agnes Pauline, Elizabeth Street, a train full of orphans just like Vivian and Duchy, heading out of New York City to the Midwest. But Molly didn't put anything in her report about how Maisie survived the fire. That part is just for Vivian. And now she's finished, and we'll turn it in tomorrow. Molly pats the papers gently. It's Sunday morning, and she's got the rest of the weekend to herself. That's the problem, though. She doesn't really want to spend the whole day by herself. Before she can decide what to do, there's a knock on her door. Molly doesn't bother to say, "Come in." Dina always opens the door right after she knocks. She does it this time. Standing in the doorway, she tosses something soft in Molly's direction. Molly grabs it out of the air. "Saw it in the thrift shop," Dina says as Molly stares at the thing in her hands. "I thought of you." It's the tie-dyed t-shirt with turtles swimming across the front, blue and green, like tiny planets. "I like turtles," Molly says in astonishment.
"I know that. Why do you think I got it?"
Molly can't think of anything to say.
"Thanks? You'll look like a hippie," Dina says with a grin, turning to leave. "But I guess that's better than looking like a vampire."
"Is it?"
"Marginally. Why don't you put it on and see if it fits?"
She turns and heads for the kitchen, shutting the door behind her. Laughing to herself, Molly gets up and tries the t-shirt on. She studies herself in the mirror. It fits perfectly.
"Dina, who would have thought? People can surprise you."
Maybe it's time Molly tries surprising somebody. After all, she had the guts to go back to the library and to tell Vivian the truth about the book and about Maisie. Maybe she has the guts for this, too. She picks up her phone and dials Jack's number. "Hey," she says when he picks up. "It's me, Molly."
"Yeah, I know."
Jack sounds surprised.
"It's not like I deleted your number from my phone, Moll. Just because we had a fight?"
Molly isn't quite sure what to say, but she's the one who made the phone call, so she guesses it's on her.
"It's a nice day out there, right?"
"You called me to talk about the weather?"
"No. I called you to ask if you want to take a hike with me," Molly says. "How about Flying Mountain?"
Chapter 22. Spruce Harbor, Maine, present day.
It's what Jack always calls a Maine postcard day. White fluffy clouds in a clear blue sky, the sea glinting in the sun, pine trees glowing a deep green, little trout lilies blooming in the shady woods. Wearing her new t-shirt, Molly sits next to Jack on a shelf of granite at the very top of the mountain, looking out to sea.
"So you finished the attic?"
he asks, tossing a pebble over the edge, not looking at Molly.
"Uh-huh,"
Molly nods. "Vivian didn't want to get rid of much. In the end, most of it's still up there, just a lot neater." Jack throws another rock. "Listen," Molly says. "I know Terry wanted me to clean out the attic, but I think what Vivian really wanted was to see what was inside those boxes one more time. So we did that, and I'm glad. And, by the way, I told her the truth." Jack looks alarmed.
"Told her what truth?"
"That I stole the book. That I wasn't just doing community service for a school project."
"Molly!"
Jack groans. "What about my mom? She needs that job." "I didn't say anything about your mom," Molly went on. "Look, Jack, Vivian is not upset about any of it. She totally understood, and the attic's finished, so..." "Can you stop being mad at me now?" is what she really wants to ask. "Can your mom stop thinking I'm some kind of juvenile delinquent?" To her surprise, Jack seems to be reading her mind.
"Okay, I get it."
"You do?"
"Yeah. I actually think it's cool that you fessed up. I was just worried you'd get my mom in trouble."
Molly nods. "She took a risk recommending me to Vivian."
"Should have known you'd handle it," Jack says. "You've got guts, Ma."
She smiles at him. "I'm going back over there in a few days," she says. "You can tell your mom, if you want, so she's not surprised."
"Just to hang out with Vivian?"
"She decided to get a laptop," Molly says. "She needs someone to help her set it up and teach her how to use Google. So that's what I'm going to do."
"I'd like to see that,"
Jack says, smiling back. Lori holds out her hand. "Let's take a look at those papers." Molly gives her the community service forms. All her hours are dutifully filled out and dated. Vivian has signed the forms, so has Ralph.
"Impressive,"
Lori opens up her folder to put the community service forms away. So look at this, a teacher put a note in here. Molly tenses. Mr. Reed, Lori says. Says you did an assignment for his class, a portaging project? What's that? Just a history report? Molly mumbles. Why? She feels a flutter of nervousness. Mr. Reed hasn't handed back their papers yet. She'd been so proud of that report, but maybe he didn't like it. Well, Mr. Reed says you went above and beyond. He wrote that right here. Says he submitted your paper and a few other exceptional ones to the public library. That's his word. Exceptional. You didn't know? Molly sits upright, blinking. She shakes her head. I guess every year Mr. Reed sends a few of the best papers to Mrs. LeBlanc at the library, Lori goes on, and they keep them in the local history section for people to read if they want to know more about Spruce Harbor. Pretty exciting, huh? Lori smiles. Molly feels like she's glowing. I'm proud of you, Molly. Lori closes her folder. You're doing well, so stay out of trouble, okay? I'll try, Molly says, grinning. No promises. You don't want your job to get too boring, do you? No chance of that, Lori says. Vivian's new laptop has arrived. Molly shows her how to turn it on and open the web browser. She bookmarks the New York Times and sets up an email account. You can send me an email when you want me to come over, she tells Vivian.
Old school, says Jack, looking over their shoulders. You should just message each other.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, Vivian says. Touchpad. What's a touchpad again? Oh, I see.
Molly explains how to use the search engine, and before she knows it, they're pulling up one site after another about the orphan train riders.
Some of the 250,000 children who rode the train are still alive. There are books and newspaper articles, plays and events. There's a website where riders can tell their stories and post photographs, as well as links to historical records and archives. Vivian gasps.
What is it? Asks Molly.
I think, Vivian murmurs, leaning close to the screen. I think I may have just found Carmine.
Who's Carmine?
Jack asks. A boy Vivian knew growing up, Molly tells him. Where, Vivian? Vivian is looking at a black-and-white photograph of a dark-haired toddler, his arms thrown wide, a beaming smile on his face. The caption says, Carmine Luton, Minnesota, 1929.
They didn't change his name? Molly asks.
Apparently not, Vivian says. Look, here's the woman who took him out of my arms that day. She points to the screen at a picture of a slight, pretty woman standing next to a tall, thin man. Carmine, with his dark curly hair and crossed eyes, nestles between them. Farther down the page, there's a picture of him on his wedding day, his eyes no longer crossed. He's wearing glasses and beaming beside a chestnut-haired girl as they cut a big white cake. There's a paragraph about his life. Molly reads it eagerly. He became a salesman like his adoptive father. He had one child, a son. He lived in Minnesota his whole life and died peacefully at the age of 74.
So Carmine was happy, Vivian says, nodding.
Good. The page was created by Carmine's son. Molly goes to Facebook and types in his name, Carmine Luton Jr. There's only one in Minnesota. I can set up an account for you if you want, she tells Vivian. You could send his son a friend request or a message. Vivian peers at the Facebook picture of the younger Carmine with his wife and grandchildren on what looks like a vacation to Disney World.
Goodness, I'm not quite ready for that.
Later, maybe. If I decide to do it, would you help me? Molly feels a wide smile spreading across her face.
Of course I will.
I got what you asked for at the supermarket, Dina says, but I don't know if we can keep doing this. Buying all these fancy vegetables could eat up my salary pretty quick. Molly is in the kitchen with Ralph and Dina, chopping mushrooms and peppers on the cutting board. There's a pile of grated cheese next to the vegetables and a stack of tortillas on the counter. She offered to cook dinner, thinking that if Dina actually tries a few meals that don't have a big hunk of meat in them, she'll see that being a vegetarian isn't so weird. So tonight, it's quesadillas. Molly learned how to make them from a teenaged girl in her last foster home.
Come on, Dina, Ralph says calmly, reaching over Molly's shoulder to take a pinch of the shredded cheese. Meat's a lot more expensive than this stuff, and it looks pretty good to me. What do we do next, Mol?
You heat the butter on the griddle, and then you put a tortilla on and fill it up with whatever you want, Molly tells him. And you put another tortilla on top. She shows him with one for herself. Cheese and mushrooms. After a few minutes, Ralph lifts the quesadilla off the griddle, golden brown, with melted cheese dripping out of the sides. Molly remembers how she used to fry eggs with her father, standing on a stool so she could see over the top of the skillet, holding a big black plastic spatula.
Not so fast, Molly Molasses, he'd say. Easy. Otherwise the eggs will go splat.
Molly takes a quesadilla over to the table, where Dina is sitting, and slides it onto her plate. Dina looks at it suspiciously and takes a bite.
Cheese and tomatoes and peppers, Ralph says. Good, huh?
Dina chews and swallows.
It's actually not bad, she says with surprise. What should we make this weekend? Ralph asks Molly. How about pizza? As long as I get to add pepperoni to my half.
I'm up for it, Molly says. By the way, Megan asked me to come over to do homework at her house tomorrow.
Okay, so why don't we do something fun tonight? How about a movie?
We could just watch Netflix at home, maybe, Molly suggests. And then she's surprised at herself. When did she start thinking of Ralph and Dina's place as home? She's never even told them for sure that she wants to stay. But somehow they're all assuming it, and that's okay with her. Sure, it's not a perfect family. Dina and Ralph don't exactly feel like a mother and father. But Ralph is funny, and she and Dina are starting to get along. As Vivian would say, it's enough.
Netflix, Ralph says scornfully. Don't be so boring. We should see something on a big screen.
Fine, Dina says. I get to vote on the movie, though. Hey, can you make me another one of those cheese things, Mol? Molly looks over at Dina's plate. She's eaten her entire quesadilla.
You liked it, huh? It was better than I thought. This time, add some mushrooms, though.
Sure thing. Molly moves back to the cutting board. She and Ralph get to work. Soon the griddle is sizzling and there's another plateful of quesadillas ready for the table. The kitchen smells of melting cheese and frying onions, a rich, warm smell. And Molly's mouth is watering. She brings Dina a tortilla loaded with cheese and mushrooms and peppers and slides one onto her own plate. Dina takes a huge bite and smiles at her.
Molly could get used to this.
Yes, it's beginning to feel like home. Orphan Train Girl, Short History. Orphan Train Girl highlights a little-known but historically significant moment in our country's past. Between 1854 and 1929, so-called orphan trains transported more than 250,000 orphaned, abandoned, and homeless children, many of whom, like Vivian Daly, were first-generation Irish Catholic immigrants from the coastal cities of the eastern United States to the Midwest. These children were indentured or contracted, which meant that they were expected to work without pay until the age of 18 or 21. Charles Loring Brace, who founded the program, believed that hard work, education, and firm but compassionate child-rearing, not to mention Midwestern Christian family values, were the only way to save these children from a life of sin and poverty. Until the late 1930s, there were no government programs like welfare and foster care. It is estimated that more than 10,000 children were living on the streets of New York City at any given time. Many of the children had experienced great trauma in their short lives, and they had no idea where they were going. The train would pull into a station, and the local townspeople would assemble to inspect them, often closely examining teeth, eyes, and limbs to determine whether a child was sturdy enough for field work or intelligent and mild-tempered enough to cook and clean.
Babies and healthy older boys were typically chosen first. Older girls were chosen last. After a brief trial period, the children became indentured or contracted to their host families. If a child wasn't chosen, he or she would get back on the train to try again at the next town. Some children were warmly welcomed by new families and towns. Others were beaten, mistreated, taunted, or ignored. They lost any sense of their cultural identities and backgrounds. Siblings were usually separated, and contact between them was discouraged. City children were expected to perform hard farm labor for which they were neither emotionally nor physically prepared. Many of them, first-generation immigrants from Italy, Poland, and Ireland, among other places, were teased for their strange accents. Some barely spoke English. Jealousy and competition in the new families created rifts, and many children ended up feeling that they didn't belong anywhere. Some drifted from home to find someone who wanted them. Many ran away. The Children's Aid Society did attempt to keep track of these children, but the reality of great distances and spotty record-keeping made this difficult. Many train riders never spoke about their early lives. But as the years passed, some train riders and their descendants began to tell their stories. They demanded access to records that had been closed to them. One train rider I spoke with, 94-year-old Pat Thiessen, told me that when, in her 50s, she finally got her birth certificate with her parents' names on it, she shouted with joy. "I was so happy to know about myself just a little," she said. "It still feels incomplete. I keep wondering, what were my grandparents like? What did they have in my family that I could have enjoyed? Who would I be?"
This has been an Audible Studios production of Orphan Train Girl, the young reader's edition of Orphan Train, written by Christina Baker Klein with Sarah Thompson, performed by Jessica Almacy, executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik, producer Neil Basic. Copyright 2017 by Christina Baker Klein. Production copyright 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.